Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we call the class the confusion of languages and the mysterious unity of the Tower of Babel. We'd be in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, nestled in between the story of Noach and Abraham. There's a series of verses which describe the genealogy, and in the middle of that story, there's these nine verses. A very short story which you have there on the first page. The entire episode of this tower and the confusion of languages takes up all of nine psukim, and in that we're going to have to understand what exactly it is that's going on with this particular story. Now, when we've given this series of classes before with the Garden of Eden, with Cain and Hevel, there are big questions that we have to ask and little questions that we have to ask. The big questions in this particular story are going to be two. The two major questions that have to be addressed are, number one, what did these people do wrong? What happened? What was their big sin that we have this massive episode of Hashem coming down and confusing all the languages and dispersing? The sages say that they lost their chelek in Olam Haba. This generation will have no portion in the world to come. What did they do? When you read the text, when we read the actual psukim, and as we'll see, these nine verses are broken down into the first four and the back four. The first four describe what they did. Then the middle pasuk, the fifth pasuk, will describe Hashem coming down to look, and then we'll have his response in the back four psukim. When we read through these first four psukim, the text makes very little reference as to something that was done wrong, that was incorrect, some type of misbehavior that would lead to this episode of Hashem coming down and dispersing the languages. That's going to be question number one. What did they do? Question number two is going to be, if you can imagine, let's assume they did something egregious. It was horrible, it was terrible, and it needed to be stopped in this tower. And you're God. How many different methods do you have at your disposal to stop the construction of this tower? At this point, there's no such concept of different languages. We're familiar with it. We know that there are lots of different languages, and it's not something unusual. But you're living in a time where there's only one language. Everybody speaks the same. And Hashem has to destroy or stop, really, this construction. Why would He choose this new concept of new languages, never seen or heard of before? Why is that the choice that's used here to address this problem and stop their construction? Those are going to be the big two questions that we have to figure out. Here we know is where language comes from. This is going to be where the confusion starts. Why is it here that we have this concept of the confusion of languages? And what did they do so bad? What was so terrible about this construction that resulted in that ramification of that result? Let's begin. The way that I want to do this is we'll actually read through the psukim. We're going to deal with one question tonight, will be what they did. First four, maybe five psukim. And then we'll take a look at the back half of the story, Mirtz Hashem, next week. So you have in your packets, what you have is the actual text of the Chumash in the first page. We have a couple of additional sources we'll look at, and then we have the commentary of Rav Hirsch. So what I want to focus on in this particular approach is that of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who was one of the great leaders of the German Jewish community at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s. I think he died right before the turn of the century, late 1800s. His writing is beautiful, it's poetic, it's very difficult. So I photocopied the entire thing for you. You have it in its entirety. And I have underlined certain parts. We're not even going to read all of the underlines, but this way, if you can keep the sheet, and if you want to work through it more in depth, you'll have it, you'll have some parts to focus on, and you'll have the entirety of his commentary. We will be reading some of it inside. His language is so powerful and so beautiful, it would just be it would be a shame to read it, to learn it with his commentary and not actually read it in his words. This is not exactly his words. He wrote it in German, but at least the translation of his words. So let's begin. Let's get right into it. The Torah begins, again, this is the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, right after the story of Noach and the flood, right before the introduction of Avram, Vayehi Chol Ha'aretz, Sofo Echos Udvarim Achadim. The whole earth, Chol Ha'aretz, was of one language, a Sofo Echos Udvarim Achadim, and was, Dvarim are also means words, Lidaber is to speak, and Achadim also comes from the word Echad. So they were of uniform, or unified words. The obvious problem in this pasuk? Excellent. What's the repetition? What does it mean? What's the difference between being of one language, which would seem to mean pretty obvious, we all spoke the same language, and then we were dvarim achadim. Not only were we one language, but we are also unified in words, or of uniform words. We'll have here a pshat and a drash. Rashi just quotes the Medrash on this, but let's start with the pshat. Rav Hirsch writes, as far as what it means to have uniform words, that we speak the same language, so that the actual structure, the phonetics of our language is the same, and that the meaning of the words that we say are also the same. So that, for example, just a couple of examples, we're going to talk a lot more about this next week, but if I said that on my way over here tonight, the most incredible story happened to me. Unbelievable. And I tell you the story. Would you believe me? You believe me? Even though I just told you that it was incredible, which means that it's not to be believed, it has no credibility, and it's unbelievable. So I told you that what I'm about to say to you is absolutely not valid, and it's an outright lie. And you believe me? The answer is yes. Because what do I mean when I say it was unbelievable and incredible? I really just mean it was fantastic. So we all agree that the words that I'm using, unbelievable and incredible, even though they might technically mean one thing, but we are actually in agreement that the way those words are used actually means something. Whereas if we would have somebody who literally learned how to speak out of a dictionary, or off one of those programs, that you could buy online, whatever, and they would hear that same phrase without having any context of the way that we use these words, they would actually have thought, they would not understand it the way that we did, because we agree what those words actually mean. Or if I say, while I was online, I had the most amazing chat. What do I mean when I say that phrase? While I was online, I had the most amazing chat. Well, if I made that statement in around 1980, what would I have meant when I said those words? I was standing in line at the supermarket, and I had a lovely chat with the person standing behind me. And we would all agree that that's what I meant. If I make that statement in 2011, what do I mean? I was sitting in front of my computer online having a chat with somebody who I may or may not actually know exists or who they are, and I had an online chat with someone. And the same words would mean entirely different things. Says Rav Hirsch, Dvarim Achadim means not only do we speak the same language, that the words online, that's both English, but that the meaning of the words are the same. We're describing a time where everybody spoke the same language and everybody agreed what the words that they said, what those words meant, what they referred to, what the neshama, the soul of those words were. Everybody was in agreement, both of the phonetics of the language, it's the same language. It's not that one person is speaking French or Hebrew or English. We're all speaking the same language and the meaning of all the words are the same. That's Pshat, says Rav Hirsch, and what that means. Now Rashi already tells us, if you flip one page, just to get into the Medrash, Rashi sees, or Chazal really see, in this double language of Safa Achas, that it was one language, and yet at the same time it was also of uniform words, Chazal saw that's unnecessary, it's extraneous. There must be some other meaning of Dvarim Achadim. And Rashi writes this on number one on your sheets. Safa Achas, Rashi points out, first of all, what does it mean they were one language? It was the Holy Tongue, it was Lashon HaKodesh. And this is going to be a very instrumental point when we get a little bit later, next week, when we get into the whole point of the story, but that this was the original language of Lashon HaKodesh, no other language that yet existed, and that's what everybody was speaking at this time. What's then the double repetitive language of unified words, says Rashi? Bo, he gives three interpretations from Chazal, from the sages. Bo Be'etza Achas. They were unified in their plan. What was their plan? Lo chol heimenu shi'avar lo es elyonim. It's not fair, not right, that Hashem should select for Himself the higher realms and leave us down here in the tachtonim. He's all by Himself up there. We have to share this whole world down here. Na l'lirakia v'nasa imo milchama. Let us charge up to the heavens and wage a war against Him. Now this Rashi is a famous Rashi, whether or not you've seen it inside or not, but most people would say, if you spoke about the Tower of Babel, what were they doing? They would answer, they were waging a war against God. Where do we get this idea from that they were waging a war against God? Because Rashi says, on the repetitive language of Udvarim Achadim, it already said they spoke one language. Why does it say they spoke uniform words? So Rashi quotes from Chazal, they were uniform, not just in the words they spoke, but in their plan of action, that their words of their complaints against God were all the same. And they were uniform that we're going to have to wage a war because it's inappropriate that God should have the higher realms all for himself and we should be down here. Let's go fight a war. Now, I'm going to repeat what I said earlier. Big question number one on the table is, where did the sages see this? When we're going to go through the rest, the next three verses, we're going to go through the rest of the story. This is a pretty strong claim that the sages are making from the phrase, Udvarim Achadim. There's an extraneous phrase that they spoke uniform words. Where did they see that the uniform words that they spoke were such a harsh negative waging a war against God? Maybe they spoke uniform words that they all wanted to, open up the same type of business together. But the sages saw in something very harsh, that it was a war against God, and we're going to have to find where did the sages see that they would comment this on this particular extraneous phrase. And that's what we're going to see from Rav Hirsch, where he finds in the little questions that we're going to ask on the text. Why does the text say it like this and why not like that? From the little questions that we'll ask, we'll flesh out the bigger questions and understand where hopefully the sages are coming from. Rashi quotes two other opinions, which you could take a look at on your own. Various other approaches of the sages, all of which are along that same line of we can go against God, or in the last one, a little bit less offensive against Hashem himself, that they were concerned that in every 1600 or so years the firmament collapses as it did during the days of the flood. Let's go up and make supports for it. We need to help out God. He apparently doesn't know how to run his world. Every once in a while the whole world gets destroyed. We will take it upon ourselves and we will support the heavens. That's what Rashi quotes from the sages. As far as Pshat goes, again, Rav Hirsch writes, it's the simple meaning of they were of the same language and of the same meaning of the words were the same. Let us go on. Pasuk Beis. Vayihi b'nasa amim mikedem. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east. Vayimtzu'u v'ka'a b'eretz Shinar. They found a valley or a plain in the land of Shinar. Vayeshvu sham. And they settled there. Something very backwards about this pasuk. They journeyed from the east, and they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. Somebody takes a trip. What kind of information would you ask for if someone's embarking on a trip? Where are you going? You're starting on a trip. So as you begin your journey, where are you going? How does this pasuk read? Right, the other way around. Where were they going? Who knows? But where were they going? There's an answer to that question. Away from the east. That's what the pasuk says, which is you wouldn't normally say that. You would say, I have a destination, so I want to get to my destination, so I travel to it. Okay, I have to leave where I'm in right now, that place, to get where I want to go, but that's where I'm going. And this pasuk says it's the exact opposite. This pasuk says, and it was in their journey from the east that they found this valley, they found this plain, and they decided to settle there. That seemed to work for them. Says Rav Hirsch, if you want to flip two pages, just to see, and in his words, we'll take one quick look. On the top of page 205, Rav Hirsch's commentary is on the bottom half of the page of 205. The word that's used is nasa'a, vayihi binasa'am, from their traveling. Now, Rav Hirsch was a tremendous linguist, and he points out that the word nisa also means, with an aleph, means to lift something from the place which it is. If I want to carry something or lift something, which is a related word, nasa'a, with an ayin, which is the word that our pasuk uses, which means to travel, or is related to the word nasa'a with an aleph, to lift up, in which I take something from one place and I bring it to another place, which is related to the word nisa, like a test, a nisayon, in which God is picking us up from one place and putting us in another place. The test is, I'm in my comfort zone in this one place where I am. I like it here a lot. And something new happens to me where I'm now forced into a new place. I've been moved from the place that I'm in into some place new, some type of new environment or circumstance in life. And that's the test that I've now been given. Nasa, with an ayin, to travel, is that same language of moving from one place to another place. But as Rav Hirsch writes, it's a voluntary, the underlined part a couple lines in, a voluntary moving away from the place one occupies now. It is probably never a compulsory going away, but always to a more attractive place. The language of nasa'a, to travel, is where you see something better there than what I have here. In the same way, to carry is to pick from here and move to there. Test is to pick up a person from one place and move him someplace else. To travel is to be moved from one place somewhere else. However, what he points out is what we pointed out, is that they moved away from the east. It wasn't that they had a destination in mind. They just needed to not be where they were. Skipping two lines to the underlined part, the older generation remained there. In the east, kedem is a word which is used very often in the Torah to refer to the east, and it also refers to that which came before, and it's often a reference to Hashem. When Lot leaves Avraham, so the Pasuk describes as he traveled mikadmon, also from the east. And the sages there comment that he was not only traveling physically from the direction of the east, but he was traveling mikadmono shel olam, from the one who came before the whole world, because the word kedem has two meanings. Kedem means lahakdim, to come earlier before, and it means the east. And the sages often find that when the Torah uses a person traveling from the east, they're also traveling from the conceptual idea of traveling away from God. And in the east, says Rav Hirsch, is Noach, Shem ve'Aver, the establishment, the older generation, those who already had been in existence, who had created the source of society and of culture, was there already, and they didn't want anything to do with that. That's where the older generation was. But the younger generation no longer felt at ease there. They felt themselves able to fly on their own wings, and they went forth, as our sages say, Mikadmono shel olam. They're leaving away from the yeshivas, from the established community, from the shuls. We got to do our own thing. They're traveling from the east more than anything else. As he writes two lines later in the underlined part, Benas Am, in their travels, they were on their journey away from their homeland. Getting away was their objective. That's why the Torah says it that way, says Rav Hirsch. They sought something better, something more attractive, and they found a valley or a plain, a place that had nothing, no, without mountains, without forests, where it was free, and that's where they wanted to settle. Here's where we can start and we can build something. So setting up what we have so far, says our first, so we have a group of people that's specifically traveling away. They want something new, they want something different, they don't want to be part of the old world, the older generation. We can do this on our own, they say. Continuing on. Pasuk Gimel. Vayomru ish el re'ehu. So one says to another, Hava nilbanot levenim. Come, let us make bricks. The nisrafa lisrafa, and burn them in fire. Fatihibahem halaveno la'evan, and the brick will serve them as stone, or serve them as stone. The hachemar, and the slime or the bitumen that they created, hayolahem lachoimer, serve them as mortar. Interesting pasuk. If you take a quick peek at Pasuk Dalet, the next Pasuk, you'll see how odd Pasuk Gimel is. We'll just take a look at the first phrase of Pasuk Dalet. And they said, Vayomru, Hava Nivna Lanu Ir, let us build a city. Umigdol Verosha Bashamayim, and a tower with its top in the heavens. Let us make for a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the face of the whole earth. We'll get back to the details of Pasuk Dal, the fourth Pasuk. But when you take 3 and 4 together, what's odd about 3 in relationship to 4?
You would think that the Hezbollah would be come before the actual.
Right. Well, the plan. What's the plan here? What do they want to do? You know, the person you answer is, let's build a city. Let's build a tower. Okay, great idea. Well, we need some materials. Hey, let's make for ourselves some bricks. But what's the first thing they say? We need bricks. We're gonna create mortar. So it was as we'll see in reverse, the first thing they have is, we're going to build something. Now, bricks and mortar is not necessarily odd to us, but the Torah makes it very clear that this was something unusual. Because what was the general building material that they would have used? Stone. The Torah says they needed to make bricks to serve them as stone, because stone was generally the material that you would use to create a structure, and then you would use that with the mortar. You would have to put the stones together. And they had neither. So they had to create the slime, so to speak, that they would use for the bricks that they were creating to build. Now, what's the difference between using bricks or using stone in your building as a building material? So the main difference is that stone is a natural product. Stone is a God-given product. You might need to shape it and form it a little bit, but they also come in different colors and different shapes and different sizes. But brick is a man-made objective. Brick is the ability where we are going to be able to create and do that which we want to be able to do versus using the stone that had been used previously. The stone which had been created by God for that purpose. We don't need that. We're not going to use that. We don't even have that here. We're in this empty plain, this valley that doesn't have anything. We are going to create brick. Let's take a look at Pasuk Dalet, and then we'll read Rav Hirsch's commentary on these two psukim. So we have a group of people, again, everybody's speaking the same language, they have the same meaning, shared meaning, and they're traveling away. This group doesn't want to be part of the old group. They're moving away from the east, they find this empty valley, and they decide to settle, and they make an announcement. Let's make bricks. Let's create a fire. And we'll have bricks which we'll use to be able to build with, and we'll have this chemar, we'll have this slime to be able to serve as a mortar to build these, put these bricks together. And then in Pasuk Dalet, which we start, and what are we going to do with all of these bricks? Let's build for ourselves a city. Hava nivne lanu ir, come let us build the city. Now you'll note there are two vayomrus. There was a vayomru in the beginning of Pasuk Gimel, and they said, and then another vayomru in the beginning of Pasuk Dalet, another statement. Vayomru, hava, come. Let us build a city. Both Psukim, Gimel and Dalet, have the word Hava, come, an invitation to the people to be part of this. Let us all be part of this adventure, building these bricks, creating the slime that we'll have. Come, let us all be part of this together. Let us build for ourselves a city. Umigdol, and a tower, Virosho Bashamayim, a tower with its top up in the heavens. V'nasa lanu shem, and we will make a name for ourselves. Pen nafut al penei chol haaretz, lest we be dispersed across the face of the whole earth. Why are they building the city? Why? Well, first of all, they're building two things. They're building a city and they're building a tower. Why are they building it? So Torah says to have two things. Nasa lanu shem, that we should have a name for ourselves, and pen nafut, lest we be dispersed. So if we took a step back, okay, we have a group of people that are traveling away from the east, they get to this plain, they want to make some bricks, they want to build a city, they want to build a tower, they want to make a name for themselves. I don't know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how terrible is that? I don't know. Text just says they want to make a name for themselves. And what's their fear? That they don't want to be dispersed. I don't know. Is this the worst thing in the world that we've come across at this point? We've already dealt with Noah and the flood and all that they did wrong. And here we have a group of people wanting to build a tower for a name for themselves. And they want to not to be dispersed. Pasuk Hey, which we'll just do again to be able to get back to Dalet. Vayered Hashem lirosa sa'ir v'yesamigdol. Hashem descends to come to look at the city and to come to look at this tower, Asher Bonu Bnei Ha'adam, to see that which the sons of man have built. First is going to point out, as does Rashi in fact, that when we have a concept of Hashem descending to see, so there's something that needs to be looked at more clearly, something that needs to be looked at more closely to see what's going on. If the objective, if the inherent problem of this tower was in the tower itself, so then I don't know that we would see, says the first, Hashem needing to descend to take a look. If we have the concept of Hashem descending to see, then it's a much deeper, fine point in the intentions that these men had in building it, that Hashem says, I need to go down and be a part of this. I need to see what's going on. But something is apparently awry. Something is amiss. That Hashem has to descend to see. This is going to be the first time, we will see it in several other places in the Chumash, but this is the first where we see the concept of Hashem descending to take a look at something. And it's usually not for good things. When Hashem descends to take a look, something is going off. on the reason why the world exists. Something significant, something terrible is happening, and he needs to come to either stop it or take a better look and understand it. And again, going back to question number one, we read all four verses. If you were to answer the question right now and say, well, what was he looking for? What did they do that Hashem has to descend and take a look, and as we're going to see, stop this process and disperse them throughout everything else? What did they do? They read four verses. They left. They built a tower. They built a city. They wanted to make a name. They didn't want to be dispersed. Okay. Where is the big problem that he needs to descend and take a look at these people? Let's take a look at how he first understands this. Start on the top of page 206. You know, the pages are a little bit upside down as you flip them. On the top of page 206, the Rafersh is dealing with their original statement of come, let us build bricks and burn a fire. And Rafersh points out the phrase the Torah uses is Nisrafa Lisrafa at the end of the very first line on the top of page 206. Nisrafa Lisrafa, which means to burn Lisrafa for the fire, as opposed to Nisrafa Srafa without that extra lamed. If it would have said Nisrafa Srafa, that would say, let's make a fire. Nisrafa Lisrafa, come let us burn it to make a fire, has a slight nuanced difference of meaning. When you have that extra lam, it says, first, what is that? It doesn't say, let us make a fire, but let us burn whatever it is to make a fire. Nisrafa, we need to burn whatever we can get our hands on, lisrafa, in order to make a fire. Skipping down to the underline of the two paragraphs later. They found a plain where all building material was lacking. What does it mean they needed to build whatever they could find for fire? What's the significance in that? There they wanted to remain to see if they cannot make something by themselves. Let us make artificial man-made stones. We don't need the God-given stones anymore. But Hava, come, let us see what we can create. And just as there was no material for building, so is there no material for burning to bake such a huge quantity of bricks. So Nisrafa Lisrafa, let us burn whatever we can to make a fire. Here the object is not mentioned what they were burning. It says Nisrafa. Nisrafa what? Burn what? No, just Nisrafa, burn whatever Lisrafa in order to have a fire. Let us burn whatever it is. Whatever we can find. And so the bricks served for them as stones, and what otherwise is only used as a binding material, as mortar, they used as a building material. Elsewhere, one built with stone and cemented with clay. The stone, the chomer, was the building material, clay was the mortar, and both were provided by nature. But here, both were artificially man-made products. And what was previously only chemer, they used for chomer, what previously used for the mortar, they used as the bricks. They were going to take the materials and totally reshape them so that they were now the ones forming and creating by burning whatever they can find in terms of being able to make their building materials. Says Rafersh, going on to the next part, where we see God descending to take a look. If he needs to come down to look, by the underlined paragraph accordingly the wrong and the danger to the whole moral future must lie in the purpose for which it was built and the feelings which actuated the builders. That concept that we mentioned, if Hashem needs to come down to look, that means the problem here is not the tower itself, because he wouldn't need to descend to take a look at the tower. He's descending to take a look at what's going on in their heads? What are they thinking? What is their intention in building this particular? And what do we find there? What's their intention? Na'ase lanu shem. Let us make a name for ourselves. If you're an entire generation, and you're concerned with making a name for yourself, says the first, who are you concerned with? And I was like, who do you want should hear about your name? So if you're a whole, if you're a unit, if you're a generation, so you have that which is above you, you have God, and you have that which is below you. What is below you if you are the entirety of the generation? So Rav Hirsch suggests, and this is what he's going to take now throughout his entire understanding of this story, you have the individual. You have the individual. The next up on the hierarchy is the community. And then above the community, you have God Himself. If a community says, let us make for ourselves a name, who are they talking to when they say, we need to make ourselves a name as this community? Says at first, she suggests they're describing what we are going to be like in the eyes of the individual below us, that we should be, have a name for ourselves as a community. Now, look at the bottom line. Accordingly, of 206, the whole community came together in a plain. They come to the idea there where there are no forests, no rocks, no stone, nothing provided by nature. It's just us. They will manufacture everything by human hands, and they see thereby what a community can do if they all join forces and work together, how they can overcome and master nature. Hava, come, let us join together and see what we can do. Now, in this, as Rav Hirsch is going to explain, they were absolutely correct. A community is far more powerful than the individual. It's not for nothing, says Rav Hirsch in his poetic language, that God created men so different from one another. Why are we not all the same? Why don't we think the same? Why don't we act the same? Why don't we believe the same types of things? Why is it that we are so vastly different? Says Rav Hirsch, because of our differences, when we come together, what's created is so powerful. Because we now take into account, we're not just a lot of the same. Now we have a unified entity that's a combination of all of these different things. And when you have all of these different things, then what's created is far stronger than any of those individuals combined or alone. And they were right when they picked up on that and they said, Hava, come, join together. We have nothing here. There are no natural materials. We're going to make it anyway. We're going to find a way to build bricks. We're going to find a way to create the mortar. We're going to build a city and a tower in the middle of nowhere. And we're going to be the ones to do it. They were right that the power that they would have together would far surpass any of them as individuals. And the Ribbono Shel Olam, Hashem Himself, uses His power all the time. One of my favorite medrash that I like to quote is Rav Shlomo Volbe Zatzal quotes this in his piece, Getting Ready for Rosh Hashanah. Quoting the same pasuk that Rav Hirsch quotes here, V'agudoso al Eretz Yisadah, that Hashem founded His kingdom on an aguda, on a bundle, on His bundle of the Jewish people. It's on that bundle that He founded His kingdom. So the Medrash writes, on this idea of putting things together, the Medrash writes that Hashem, a mashal, a parable to a king, who says to his subjects, I want to build a palace, and I want you to build me this palace. But the only catch is I want you to build me this palace out at sea, in the middle of the ocean. And I want you to take two ships and use those two separate ships as the foundation for my palace. And they say, how are we supposed to do that? Well, there's only one way to do that. You have to tie the two ships together and then anchor the ships to the ocean floor. And if two ships are anchored to the floor and tied to each other, then they can serve as the foundation for a palace. Says the Medrash, so too says Hashem to His Jewish people, I want you to build me a palace. But the palace that I want you to build is on each other. You can only be unified. I don't want a palace of individualized Jews. I need Jews all together. And on that, my palace will stand. So you better root yourself to the ocean floor. That's me. Attach yourself to me and attach yourselves to each other. And even though the two of you will be rooted in different places, you might have different ideas. But if you're all attached to each other, on that, in that connection that we have, you can build. And first, as a community, has a very different power than the individual. He quotes a statement from Chazal, from the sages, Ein Tzibur Meis, Ve'ein Tzibur Ani. A community never dies, and a community isn't poor. Individuals do, but not a community. Just as a parable, you take the human body. The human body is comprised of billions and billions of cells. So the scientists tell us that every individual cell in our body has a shelf life of, I don't remember exactly what it is, several months. And then the cell dies. Which means that every single cell in our body now was for sure not around a year ago. 2 years ago, 10 years ago, and certainly not 40 years ago, so that we're actually completely new. Every single component of our body is new. Yet, we age. And we are still here and still the same. Because the unit outlives the individuals that comprise that unit. And individual cells can be replaced constantly, one at a time. Never at the same time, obviously. That would result in death. But as one at a time, over the course of a long period of time, they're constantly renewing and constantly changing and constantly refreshing themselves. And the organism as a whole remains. It's true by communities also. The community is the community. The members of this community, none of whom were here 50 years ago. Maybe one or two left. But the community stays. And the individual, every year, the couple come in, a couple leave, a couple come in, a couple in, year after year after year. And the community outlives all of the individuals that make up and comprise that community. That's the power of community, that when you form a new entity, the individuals not only have more power because they're part of that, but now they last, there's like an eternity almost in that community because of the fact that they've been combined together through that. Says Refersh, that's the way that it was set up, and it's supposed to be that way, and that's the power that we can have. I'd like to read a little bit inside it, on 207, smack in the middle of that first paragraph, in the middle of the line, there's a sentence begins with the phrase, but. But the community only stands there as the flower of perfection. This idea that we're describing, how a community can create so much more and is so powerful and has an element of eternity to it, when is it the flower of perfection if it takes the same stand towards God as the individual should? Meaning, the individual needs to dedicate himself to God. When individuals get together and form a community, and that community dedicates itself to God, so then that community is that flowering of perfection. If, like the individual, it does not consider itself above the law of God, meaning just like as a small individual can't say, I can't make up my own rules, I can't disregard the law of Hashem, if the community, with all of its power, also says, we are bound by those same laws, if it uses the power with which the united forces of the community invested only in the service of God, that community which is now so powerful, it has all of that power of the individuals, if it uses that power in the service of Hashem and looks on its mission as nothing other than to fulfill the service of God with the combined forces of the community more completely and more perfectly than lies in the power of the individual, that's when the community is in its state of perfection. The example that I like to give to this, which are first borrowing from another piece of first writes elsewhere, the word nasi means a leader or a prince. It's also used several times throughout Tanakh to mean a cloud. Why would the word cloud and the word prince share meanings? What's the connection between a prince and a cloud? So it first writes that a cloud functions as a repository of all of the evaporated water of the earth. Earth has lots of water, it evaporates, and it gathers together in the cloud. And the cloud now holds that power. It holds all of that water. And what does the cloud do with all of that water? So it bestows it back to the earth in the forms of the rains of blessings. That's what a cloud does. It gathers and then dispenses back. A leader, says Refersh, a true prince, a true leader, functions as that cloud. He is the repository, he is the source, the gathering point of all of the individual strengths of his constituents. And now holding all of that power, gives it back to the individuals as they need it. And that's the beauty of a community. Where a community, where individuals say, I'll contribute my strengths to the community because I'm going to get someone else's strength back. I offer X, but when I'm in need, I'm going to pull out Y. A leader of a community is the one who orchestrates all that. He knows how to gather everybody's strengths and how to use everybody's in the right places. This one knows how to do this, this one knows how to do that. But the power of the community is having that ability to gather all of those things together and know when to do that. But the beauty of that, says Refersh, is only when the entire group is focused in their service of Hashem. But here lies the danger, continues Refersh. Whereas the individual is finally brought by itself to realize the limitation of its power. All individuals, as great as they think they are, as powerful as we think we are, there is a point in our existence where humility sets in against our will. The limitation of age, of mind, of capability, individuals as haughty as we might ever be at our height of haughtiness, will eventually be lowered back down to reality. We'll eventually grow old, we'll grow infirm, we will not be able to accomplish what we once accomplished. But that's not true of the community, says Refersh. The individual will get caught by life, and humility will catch up to it one way or another, against your will or with your will, whether you like it or not. But that's not the case with the community, because it really is strong, says Refersh. It really does have power. Whereas the individual who thinks he's great is wrong and will eventually be seen that reality, will be shown that reality. But the community really does. It really is strong. It really is powerful. It easily comes to regard itself as the purpose of its existence, so that the community can make the mistake and say, long term, we're here for ourselves. We exist because we are the purpose of the existence, not as a tool to better serve God, a more powerful tool than any individual can be, but that we can exist for ourselves. The establishment of itself as its mission, as if the individual has importance only for the community. The community is not there for supplementing the individual, but the individual is merely a pawn for the use of the community. That sentence is a very powerful sentence. What role does the individual have in such a system? In the perfect system, the individual contributes to the community because the community knows together we can serve the individual better. So everybody together puts in their strengths into the community, because when I'm part of a community, who benefits? The individuals will eventually benefit by being part of a community. In the corrupted sense, it's backwards. The individual sacrifices his self, his talents, his strengths, his capabilities and resources for the community, so that the community can be powerful. That's a backwards and corrupted usage of the power of a community. It's really there for the individual. We give ourselves to the community, all of us who are part of a community. Why are we part of a community? Because we know it benefits us in the long run. We give to the rabbin, we give to the masses, we give to the community, because we know we serve God better individually as part of a community. We're not giving ourselves up for the sake of the community, but that the community allows each one of us to actually fulfill our mission more by being part of it. When the community says, continuing the next paragraph, we will make the powers which lie in a community recognized, that will make them all recognized, we will unite our powers to establish ourselves. If they, as the herald of God, do not call on the individuals, B'Shem Hashem, what is the community's cry? It should be B'Shem Hashem, in the name of Hashem, join us, we can serve God better together, join our community. But if they don't say join us because we serve God together, but if they place themselves there, instead of as a means, but as an end, then the whole moral future of mankind goes to ruin. And first, this is a powerful thing. When the individual sacrifices himself for the community, the entire fabric, the moral fabric of mankind is at risk, because the individual becomes a pawn. The individual no longer has a purpose. He no longer has a mission. He would sacrifice his mission to that community. Continuing the underlying part, the more originality used, the more arrogantly the community comes to believe that the community as such can dispense with God and His laws of morality, that then the community feels more and more powerful, that it doesn't have to deal with the laws of God anymore, because it itself is the purpose. The old people had to have stone, but we build even where, at the end, where there are no stone. Then the idol of an empty purpose is created. Slipping down to 208. An idol which brings no happiness, into which the individual has to give up the whole of his existence and the community its allegiance to the laws of morality. Where the individual gives up his life, his purpose, for that community. Individuals, of course, must weep when one of them falls. But at the building of the fame of the community, the toll of human lives is not counted. This line, we're going to point out another line that he's going to say, is a litmus test for how we view that. As an example, I'm not sure if this is a perfect example, but when they built the Brooklyn Bridge, the San Francisco Bridge, when they were beginning the process, it was a very dangerous adventure. They didn't have the safety measures that they had. Now, the Brooklyn Bridge instituted a huge net for the first time, and that's where they cut down the number of lives lost. Maybe the San Francisco Bridge, one of the two, lost a lot more than the other before they had that. If you would go into it and you would say in advance, I know that there are going to be 150 people who are going to lose their lives in this endeavor. Is it worth it or is it not worth it? Are you allowed to continue with the adventure, with the endeavor to build such a bridge when you know the toll of human lives that it's going to cost, and there's no way around it? It's just going to cost that. There's an interesting ethical question. Is the goal, the benefit of the project, does that outweigh the cost in lives that we know it's going to take? Can you engage in such a endeavor? Is that okay? Is it allowed to do for the cost of human lives to be able to say, we did it? So the only justification is the benefit to mankind that will occur because of the bridge. But if you were just building a bridge to say, look at what we did. Look at this wonder. We didn't really need it, but look at it. And you're going to cost lives doing so? That's this particular tower. A purposeless tower that did not serve the benefit of mankind and was going to cost the toll of the culture to do so, just to say, look at what we did. If you flip to this 209, in the second paragraph, a pithy saying from the sages sums up what it is that Refersh understands the entire project here was. If a man had a fatal accident at the building, say the sages, describing the construction of this tower, if a man died, they did not take it to heart. They pushed him aside and continued building. But if a brick fell to the ground and crushed itself and broke, they sat and wept and wailed, when shall we get another one up into its place? That statement from the sages sums up the project that's not for the sake of mankind. It's not that we're building a bridge because we need it. It's that we're building a bridge because we want to say, look at what we did. We're building a tower to show how great we are. And in that project, the individual is just a pawn. The individual who dies along the way, look what you did. You sacrificed your life for this project. But if a brick falls and delays the project, you sit and weep. And in that statement of the sages, says Refersh, they summed up what was taking place. Going back to 208, second paragraph, our sages teach that this is only successful under Nimrod. Nimrod was the leader of this generation. Nimrod was the one who was able to accomplish this. And if you go down to the bottom line with the in that paragraph, or the underlined part, not with gold or possessions, but with a little bit of a ribbon in the lapel or on the breast, does a Napoleon or an Alexander understand how to lure the masses for his purpose? And how does a leader lure the people into doing this? To give up their lives, give up themselves, give up their individuality for the sake of a greater purpose? Through the honor. Through the pin on the lapel of their uniform that will say how great they were, you can get men to sacrifice themselves for a purpose that serves them nothing, but it serves the leader his purpose. And Nimrod was able to get all the people together to say, look what we're going to do. Look at the tower we'll create. And everybody, Hava, come join together in this practice, in this adventure. In this, the pen of foots becomes understandable. What was their fear? Their fear was lest we become dispersed. Says the verse, going back into the Pasuk, finding every hint for understanding what they did. When they said, let's build a tower in a city, they said, why? Let's make for ourselves a name. Not let us get together to make for God a name. Let's make for ourselves a name. That will be the purpose of this. We will be the ones that have all the glory in the name as a community of what we can accomplish. And what was their fear? Lest we be dispersed. Says the first, it's understandable why they were afraid of being dispersed. They feared to cease to form a whole community. Where was their power coming from? Power came from the fact that they were all together, that they were a unit. What would that matter, however? What would this fear matter if they were only a union to look after the individuals? Do we as a community, just taking us as an example, is that a fear that runs through the community, maybe we'll be dispersed? It's not a fear, because no one's putting a gun to our head holding us here. Why are we here? Because we know the benefits. We want to be here, what there is to be here. Says the first, if the community was a union to look after the individuals, then what's there to fear if all that the community wanted was to enable the laws of morality to be fulfilled in a higher, more perfect degree? If we know that we can be better people, we can be a more moral people by being together, so that's the link, that's the glue that keeps us together. There's no fear maybe we'll be dispersed. If a community is what it should be, then even if it consists of millions, it requires no artificial means of holding it together. The bond lies in the consciousness of every individual, and its point of union is God. All of the individuals say, I want to serve God, and in my consciousness of each individual person says, let's do it together because we can do more together. No one, this is the brilliance of the concept of community, no one has to convince, no one has to pull people in. The community forms itself because of the commonality of purpose, the understanding that we all want to serve God. And the best way to do that is to form a powerful unit that then will allow all of us to fulfill our individual mission better by being together. There's no glue. It's ourselves, it's our own consciousness which holds us together. And therefore there's no concept of being afraid we'll be dispersed. A people who are afraid of being dispersed, says Rav Hirsch, reveal to us that there was something artificial holding them together. And the artificial nature of what's holding them together is Nimrod's leadership saying, join together for the sake of ourselves. Let's make a name for ourselves that will become great. We'll build a tower that serves no purpose, but it'll just be a tower that will show how great we are. And if that's where you're doing that, where you're serving your own purpose, the individuals get together to give themselves up to the community, then you have to artificially fear, you have to artificially hold them together and fear you might be dispersed, because if you're dispersed, you'll have no power, and you have to make sure that you hold this together. Last paragraph for tonight. With this, Nasa Lanu Shem, with that phrase of let us make for ourselves a name, with the introduction of this false so-called patriotism, where they convince everybody that we'll do this for ourselves, it's all about us, with the unchaining of the lust for fame, which in the individual is considered as a vice, but nationally as a virtue. When an individual says, I want to be great, we look at them and we say, that's not such a nice thing. But as a nation, that the nation wants to be great, that's patriotism. We're all in favor of that. But when the people were convinced to get together to be great for the sake of themselves of being great, and removed it for the sake of God's being great, then the whole moral mission of states and individuals is undermined. Because all passions have their limit of satiation, but the lust for fame has no limit. In the same way as a community is powerful, and that it never dies, and it's not poor, and it will continue for eternity because it just continues to perpetuate itself, that lust for fame is unquenchable. And when a community, that powerful unit, is after its own fame, there is no stopping it. This lust for fame has not only built its tower here, not only here has it unconcernedly burnt up everything to obtain bricks for the building of its triumph, but the whole of world history, says Rav Hirsch, has for the greatest part to relate only of such building of towers and of imaginary glory for which Nimrods have understood how to lure and force the nations. World history is just filled with leaders getting their people together to build such towers. but of the simple life of mankind. And with this idea, we will close for tonight. With the simple life of mankind, of that which goes on in the homes, the pen of history has little to relate. Open up a history book. What will the history books talk about? The accomplishments of the Alexanders, the accomplishments of the Nimrods, of the Pharaohs of Egypt, of the Napoleons. Will the history books record the simple struggle of the individual in his home to improve himself, to become a better person? Not at all, because we are lured by the power of the community that's been built by the leaders who have convinced the nation to join together to accomplish great things. But of the individual in his home, the pen of history, says Refersh, has little to relate. But in the beautiful metaphor of the sages, only God Himself records. And Elijah and Messiah, those messengers and bringers of the ultimate salvation of mankind, sign it as witnesses. The first year is referring to the Medrash. The Medrash says on three different individuals, starting by Reuven, when Reuven saw that his younger brother Yosef was being thrown into a pit, and he attempted to save his life. The Medrash says, had Reuven known that the Torah would record his efforts to save his brother's life, he would have put Yosef up on his shoulders and carried him back to their father Yaakov. And had Aharon HaKohen, Moshe's brother, had he known that the Torah would record how happy he was and how honestly joyed and overjoyed in his heart he was that his younger brother Moshe was chosen. The Torah says he came out to meet him and he was happy. But if he knew that the Torah would record that, he would have gone out with a whole band to play and welcome Moshe back to Egypt to lead the Jewish people out. And the Medrash concludes, well, what should we do? We don't have a Torah that records these things. Medrash says, we do. Every single one of our stories is being recorded for eternity. Every single one of our stories is being written down by God Himself, and it's signed by Eliyahu HaNavi and by the Melech HaMashiach. Themselves are the witnesses on the storybook that's being written on every single one of our lives, and that the battles that take place in the privacy of our homes are recorded for posterity, for all of eternity. Because the perspective, says Refersh, even when you join a community, but it's about the individual fulfilling his mission. An individual is more powerful when he's part of a powerful community. And history doesn't care about that. History doesn't record those things, but God cares about those things. And this story, says Refersh, is the corruption of the entire purpose of man's existence in this world. The existence of man in this world is to become better, to become godly as an individual, as individuals coming together as a community to serve God. When a community gets together and says, Nase lanu shem, let's make for ourselves a name and build a tower that has no purpose at the expense of the human life along the way. Tell the human to sacrifice his existence. It's only for the sake of the community to build this tower. Then the fabric of why we exist, the individual, the purpose of fulfilling our mission, is at stake. And it's that, at this point, when they make the declaration of let us make a name for ourselves lest we be dispersed, that God says, I need to go down and see what's going on. Because the entire moral fabric of existence is at stake, and I need to do something about this. Next week we'll learn, what does the confusion of language have to do with this particular threat to humankind that's posed by the construction of this tower. Great night.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.